how you feel. CEOs getting mega pay, while you barely making minimum wage. The first time I put that pen to a page, when I realized I couldn't be the government slave. I got the same attitude from back in the day. Now I got bigger bills, bigger problems to deal with, but I'm still sick. Lance Armstrong being broke is a position that ain't that comfy. What's on the menu? Bread and lunch meat. And I ain't even getting paid till next week. It's getting cold, so it's time.
I'm not saying that just if we teach the children that the world is friendly and everyone should play fair, the world will become fair. No, but if we teach them that the world is unfair and you should crush other people, that is going to create a world in which we try to crush each other.
You have to care. You have to have the mindset where you're willing to roll up your sleeves and get dirty. I have changed adult diapers. That is not something everybody wants to do. Did I enjoy doing it? Not necessarily, but it had to be done, and I did it.
It was the biggest fast food workers' strike up until that time.
During the past 9 months, as hundreds of millions of us around the world have been locked down and shut in at home, there's been increased demand for a range of different consumer products. Obvious items like toilet paper, hand sanitizer, and wet wipes, and more specialized items like fitness equipment, bakeware, sewing machines. Then, there's board games. When Hasbro, the makers of Monopoly, recently posted bumper third quarter sales figures, LHT's Patrick Dixon started to wonder about the political and historical implications of this new wave of pandemic-induced popularity for what many see as the most capitalist of all games. On today's show, Patrick discusses Monopoly and class struggle, a once popular Marxist alternative board game, I actually played it as a kid, with Keith Plocek, professor of professional practice at the Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism at the University of Southern California. On America Works, an ongoing podcast series from the Library of Congress, Joyce Vagar, a dedicated home healthcare worker from Coos County, Oregon, talks about her pride and pleasure, as well as her challenges in helping her clients remain in their own homes and communities. Vagar is one of more than 40 home healthcare workers interviewed by University of Oregon researchers for the Taking Care OFP election. This moving episode highlights the enormous and often unheralded contributions made by workers in this underdocumented profession. And on this week's Labor History in 2, Rick Smith tells us about the fight for 15 and the union. I'm Chris Garlock, and that's all ahead on this week's Labor History Today. I hope you enjoyed the show. Here's Patrick.
Show up, cause this country was built on justice. But even Lil Reese know in this struggle it's just us. So grab tu familia y dile a lucha. Estamos peleando todos los diablos que son nuestros jefes y gobierno. No podemos rendirnos, somos de Chicago. This life is hard, so hard I must go. So-called oppressors know we're at your throat. This life is hard, so hard I must go. 825, hell nah, we can't go.
Daily, it gets harder and as of lately, I've been thinking about a dream. Is it past tense? Cause it's ended. We gotta fight for it, we gotta fight for it. Is it past tense? Cause it's ended. We gotta fight for it, we gotta fight for it.
Welcome to Labour History Today. Thanks for joining me, Keith.
It's great to be here.
Just recently, Hasbro introduced their third quarter earnings report, and this really quite interested me. It showed a 21% rise in revenue to 543 million in sales of board games. And of course, Monopoly is one of the most popular products Hasbro produces. Anyway, this increase in the popularity of board games reminded me of a story you wrote several years ago about Monopoly and a political science professor called Bertel Ullman. Can you tell me a bit about what you discovered?
Well, yeah, the funny thing is I found this game called Class Struggle. I was in a hostel in Bogota, which sounds far-fetched or pretentious, but I just was sitting there and I saw a game, a board game in their stack of board games, and it had Karl Marx arm wrestling Rockefeller. And I thought, what is this? Is this some sort of a one-off joke? But then I took a lot of photos of it, and then I did a lot of research, and it turns out that it was a fairly popular game. It was invented in 1978 by an NYU professor named Bertel Ullman. It ended up selling about 230,000 copies worldwide, translated into five languages total. And he ultimately wrote a biography called Class Struggle is the Name of the Game, True Confessions of a Marxist Businessman, because it was a Marxist board game that he proceeded to want to create and become popular. But to do that, he had to become a small businessman himself. So he had to go and work within the system to, in theory, subvert the system. And as a result of reading about it, I learned that that's how I learned about the origins of Monopoly, which I didn't know at the time. I grew up playing Monopoly. But turns out it started out almost with the opposite message. It was invented in 1904 by a woman named Lizzie McGee, Maggie. And she was basically a follower of Henry George, and George's, you know, basically looking at property rights and property, just basically very much against private property in the ways we would think about it. And the whole point of it was very similar playing, but the whole point was to kind of show, look what happens. Eventually, everyone runs out of money playing this game, and one person gets to keep it. That was the original message. It had very much that messaging and the packaging and everything. But then that's not the story we're told when we learn about Monopoly at all. We see the guy with the top hat, and we think, oh, that guy's great. As a kid, I was like, I want to be that guy. It was very much, he's the good character. And that all came about around 1934 and the Great Depression. A gentleman by the name of Charles Darrow basically took the landlord's game idea, rewrapped it, and sold it to Parker Brothers as this new game. And then suddenly it was a different messaging. Suddenly it was gather all the property and beat all your friends. The rules were very similar, though. You went around the board and everything. But ultimately it became getting nice big stacks of cash in front of you. That really, Ullman saw that, got him thinking even further about creating a game. And ultimately he did create a board game that, it's not as similar to Monopoly, I think, as people might think, because it's got a different kind of board and the rules are really complex and weird, but that just really helped inspire him to create this game, and it became fairly successful for the time, or for any time, really.
You write that he ran into some conflicts as a small businessman, that it put him in some compromising situations.
Yeah, very much. And he does a great job, I'll say, I think, personally, kind of tongue-in-cheek irony as he writes about it. But he ultimately went into business with some of his friends. He ended up employing some acquaintances of his, and that became stressed as the bills started to pile up. He found how hard it was just to get paid. He could sell these games to small shops, but they weren't always paying him. So then he had to start leaning on them. He also ran into a bigger issue with Brentano's bookstore. They had striking, their workers went on strike. And of course they asked him to pull the game or at least express their support. But he decided to not do that because by his own account, everyone assumed like you've got this popular board game, you're a millionaire now. But his whole point he's trying to make is that he was not a millionaire and he was going into debt because he couldn't get anyone to pay him. And the costs were all, it was a little more difficult than he thought to make a profit. And I think there's board games are like publishing, I think, where it's just hard in general to make a profit sometimes. But on top of that, he didn't really know what he was doing, which makes a good read because it's a classic. We get to learn about it as he learns about it. It's not some expert telling us how it is. It's somebody we're going on the journey with him. At least that's how he writes it. But yeah, but it has great ironies and great like contradictions and hypocrisies even.
But he didn't change his political philosophy, I understand.
No, he's Marxist through and through. No, I did not. He did not. He did not become a capitalist. Although he does joke that he would, I forget the exact wording, but he said he used to read about downturns in the market and think, yes, the system's falling apart. But then he would read about downturns in the market when he was trying to get the game going. And, can't the market just keep going for a little while longer so I can get my socialist message out there? Which is a funny hypocrisy, but it's also, I think, in a way, inherent in some of the system because even Marx would talk about you have to work within the existing system to change it. That often leads people complaining about people being hypocritical in some ways.
I wasn't aware of Monopoly's history and how its original intention was so distorted. You also shared with me, there was some quite interesting research at Berkeley about a decade back where students were asked to deliberately play a rigged game in Monopoly. Can you share with us a bit more about that?
Yeah, basically it was, I forget the exact numbers, but they ultimately had two students in a room being filmed as a psychological experiment, and they ultimately played the game such that one player got more money to start, one player I think got to roll both dice instead of one die, and then one player got more money each time they passed go. From the very get-go, both of them were very aware of these rules. So they both were aware that this is rigged. One person's clearly going to do better in this scenario. But it was funny just looking at gestural movements and just also listening to what the people were saying in the room. Very quickly, they settled into roles where the person who was winning suddenly got cocky, and they even had more of a primate behavior, like sitting up taller. And as they were clicking their piece around the board, they were doing it louder. They even had a bowl of snacks out, and the winning person started taking more snacks. There was this weird psychology that took over. And this is 100% with them knowing that the game was rigged. So it just shows like this kind of sense of, you know, entitlement, or that comes to be, you know, the sense of like earnedness. It's not luck. I'm earning this somehow, or I deserve this, that happens over time. And I think it was very interesting that they chose Monopoly for that game. You can, in theory, have done this with a lot of different games, but I think it puts Monopoly has put itself in this position in our like cultural understanding, but just put it up as the capitalist game, the game of starting out and eventually stratification happening.
The game of private property.
Exactly.
And get a Monopoly, everyone starts off with the same amount of money and the dice are random. We're talking at the end of an election week, and Monopoly doesn't seem that obscure a topic to be discussing. So every 4 years we have this grand national experiment, and we look at the results and try and understand and make sense of who Americans are and what they believe. Some would look at Monopoly and they'd accept that it's unfair, and they'd accept the analogy to the system as a whole, and they'd say in some ways it is rigged. Lots of people accept that system because if the dice fall correctly, they can end up winning at it. I don't know. How do we make sense of Monopoly in this present cultural context? Monopoly growing again in popularity.
Yeah, I think that to back up a little bit, you know, the election just being glued to Twitter and other media these last couple of days, I think it's funny how quickly this election just confirmed that everyone was correct. Oh, well, see, obviously we went centrist and it was good. Well, obviously we did. We should have been more progressive. It would have been better. There's a lot of people just take the results and confirm their own worldview. And I think that with Monopoly, I think that people, for one, just at a basic level, I think that people think it's fun to win these games. It's fun to go around but it's also very frustrating to lose. I think ultimately it just people, they do know the system is rigged or at least unfair, and people start, they know that advantages exist, but they're just sold that they can be the guy in the top hat, that they can make it. When we love stories, there's even stories, we love hearing stories of people who started the business in their garage. We love the older, if we were older, we'd be talking about Horatio Alger novels. These little boy makes good, but everyone wants to think that they can be that person. And of course, very few people become that person, especially if they don't start out with generations of them, if they don't start out having their parents be that person. But I think that people still want to win. And I think some of that is, though, a little bit of chicken and egg, because these games do set up our expectations. Board games, they're kind of board games and sports, and our initial introduction to rules as children and like how systems work and how we're supposed to play. And if the games we are playing are set up so that we're rewarded for winning and making everyone else bankrupt, then we're going to absorb that. And so if I think that's part of what Ullman was trying to do, he was trying to rework the games and rework our knowledge of our feelings about how to win and or what winning is. Ultimately, the game is, I say all that, the game is complicated though, if you're thinking of an 8-year-old playing it and being told about it. So the messaging, he I don't know if he would have won a messaging war if it had become even more popular, but ultimately, yeah, I think that the Monopoly is going to keep being popular because people like it and because they grew up playing it. And although they don't play it as much as they used to, I think, because now there are all these more complex board games that younger people are playing.
It would seem to me that at least some conservatives would have this sort of Hobbesian analysis whereby they'd say games like Monopoly are good because they introduce children to the competitive nature of the world. But then I wonder to what degree these attitudes are universal, even if liberals themselves try to imagine that they're not. If you look at, I don't know, someone like Elizabeth Holmes, who pursued a very liberal winner-takes-all agenda as the founder of a company like Theranos, it still seems that these two models of success or these two approaches to the world, the definitions of winning might be slightly different, but is the sort of understanding of the nature of the game fundamentally the same?
I think I like the use of the referencing Hobbes, because I do think that it is adversarial in a lot of our interactions in the world, whether we want them to be or not. So even people who try to live as open and non-competitive lives as they can, oftentimes they still have to compete in the world of idea, in the battle for ideas. Even these like peaceful debates are still seen as like competitions. So we have to, and you see this with people who wish that the Democrats would, being the left party in this country, the leftish, that they wishing they would fight harder. So they're fighting harder to make the world less competitive. But so it becomes this inherent, it is still interesting contradictions. And it doesn't mean that because someone lives in contradiction or even lives with hypocrisy that they're necessarily wrong. I think that could be a fallacy. There's just so many things we all have to manage, and we all, to quote the internet, we live in a society, right? So we have to deal with some of the rules that we're given and some of the systems we're given. But I do think that, to go back, I do think that the more conservative attitude would be that, yes, the world is tough and my child is going to have to fight for everything they need. So I'm going to teach them how good it feels to win. But that is trying to teach your child what the world is and react to it. But also by teaching your children that, you are creating the world as well. So it's a little bit of, you know, back and forth. So I'm not saying that just if we teach the children that the world is friendly and everyone should play fair, the world will become fair. No, but if we teach them that the world is unfair and you should crush other people, that is going to create a world in which we try to crush each other.
Thank you so much for joining me today. It's been a real pleasure.
No, it's been fun. Thank you very much.
From the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C.
Welcome to America Works, excerpts from interviews with contemporary workers throughout the United States, collected by the library's American Folklife Center as part of its Occupational Folklife Project. This America Works podcast features Joyce Vagar, a dedicated home health care worker from Coos County, Oregon. She was interviewed by fieldworkers Nathan Moore and Donald Stacy as part of Taking Care, a library-sponsored oral history project that documented the occupational culture of home health care workers throughout Oregon. Taking Care was organized by Professor Bob Bussell from the University of Oregon. He and his colleagues worked closely with Service Employees International Union Local 503 to record 35 interviews with home health care workers, an occupation that had not previously been represented in the American Folklife Center's archive.
I live in Lakeside, Oregon, and I've been a home care worker. This May will be 13 years.
So what kind of clients have you worked with or you currently work with?
I have worked with a broad spectrum. I've done everything from hospice. I currently have my first client with Parkinson's. I've had several clients with diabetes, with Alzheimer's or dementia. I have never worked in a center. It's all one-on-one. I've lived in and I've been hourly.
Do you think that there's special skills that it takes to do this kind of work?
I think anybody could do it maybe, but not everybody could do it well. If you can do what I do and remain totally disconnected and uninvolved with the person you're doing it with, in my opinion, you should not be doing it. One of my private pay clients right now, she has some dementia and everything. She has this really big purse. It's one of those ones that's kind of open, and it has several eyelets on it and purple in it. She was like, you know, I really wish that I could find something that would close this. I'm like, well, I think shoelaces would work. She's like, oh, okay, okay. And on my day off, I was happened to be in Dollar Tree, and I happened to see purple shoelaces in Dollar Tree. And I grabbed them and took them to her the next time I worked. And she's, oh, these are perfect. It's just, it's what you do. You don't necessarily have to be bosom buddies with them, but you have to care for them. It's a prerequisite. You have to care. You have to have the mindset where you're willing to roll up your sleeves and get dirty. I have changed adult diapers. That is not something everybody wants to do. Did I enjoy doing it? Not necessarily, but it had to be done, and I did it. It is stressful, especially since there have been two separate occasions when I lived in where the person who was supposed to relieve me did not. And when I say did not relieve me, I don't mean was an hour late. I mean, she didn't show up. And so I ended up working 13 straight days without a relief. I've gotten yelled at and stuff. When you have Alzheimer's and dementia, you lose some of those filters. Things that you and I might think, but would never say.
So when you're just interacting with clients on a daily basis, like what kind of stuff do you talk about with clients?
Any and everything. You know, just talk like you talk to a friend. You know, you talk about any and everything. I like being around different people, you know, and there are times you go in on your day off because there's nobody else to go in on your day off.
Do you think there are any moments in your career that would kind of like define for somebody what it means to be a caregiver?
The lady that I lived in Lakeside, one of the first days that I was working with her, I happened to see her back, and the skin right above her tailbone was a little red. And I knew what that meant. That meant because she sat in her recliner at a certain angle all the time, she was starting to develop a pressure sore. And so because I only lived about a mile away, I would set my alarm for 2 o'clock in the morning. I would get up, get dressed, go over to her house, help her up to the bathroom, get her a drink of water, and let her dog out, and then let her dog back in. And, you know, then you help her back into bed with the pillow under the different hip. And we were able to keep the pressure sore from becoming a pressure sore. And I did that every night for about 4 months.
Do you get together with other caregivers?
Yeah. There aren't other people at our work site. When we're at our work site, we're there all by ourselves. And it's really nice to get together with other people, be able, you know, just to talk about your day or talk about things that have happened. I had one client that she had dementia. She was no longer taking baths or showers, but she'd sit on the side of her bed and we'd give her, you know, a little sponge bath. And all of a sudden she decided she didn't want to do that anymore. And I'm like, what'd I do? Because she asked to be clean. And one of my fellow caregivers said, tell her it's a beauty treatment. If we told her it was a beauty treatment, she would let us do whatever we needed to do. And I don't know if I would have thought of that on my own. And one of the things about home care workers is because the people we take care of come in all shapes, colors, and sizes, by the very nature of what we do, we are one of the most diverse work populations you will ever find.
How do you think the community at large or in Coos Bay sees the, are they aware of your work or what you guys are doing?
Some of them are aware a little bit. A lot of them are not. It's like, oh, you're a babysitter for adults. No, I'm not. Yeah. I am a professional. I am a home care worker. It's one of the things that people are going to have to start getting better about. Curry County is about one third 65 and older. Coos County, where I live, is about, I believe it was between a quarter and a fifth 65 and older. So that means that there are an awful lot of people that are either going to need help or need it presently. And they are part of our community. It's part of the covenant we make with workers in America, if you work hard and you participate all your life, at the end of your life, you're going to get to retire. You're going to have a little Social Security. You're going to have a little respect, and we're going to take care of you a little bit. If we don't do that, we're letting down what we've said we'd do as a country.
What makes caregiving different from the other jobs you've had?
I've been privileged to be the person sitting beside somebody who passes away twice now. One lady, I had been with her for 20 months, I believe, when she passed away. She got to pass away in her bed with me, her dog, and her cat in the room with her. I'm sorry.
No, but, no, go ahead. I mean, that's
yeah, and that was exactly the way she would have wanted to go. I make a difference.
You've been listening to home healthcare worker Joy Vager from Lakeside, Oregon. She was interviewed for the Library of Congress's Occupational Folklife Project by fieldworkers Nathan Moore and Donald Stacey. To see the complete video interview with Joy, as well as interviews with other home healthcare workers documented as part of the Archie Green Fellowship Project Taking Care, please visit us online at www.loc.gov/folklife. On behalf of the American Folklife Center, this is folklorist Nancy Gross. Thank you for listening to America Works.
This has been a presentation of the Library of Congress. Visit us at loc.gov.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 2012. That was the day that more than 100 fast food workers in New York City walked off the job. They held a one-day strike for better wages and the right to form a union. It was the biggest fast food workers' strike up until that time. The movement soon grew to be much, much bigger. Their demand was simple and memorable: a $15 an hour minimum wage. The slogan became the Fight for 15 and a Union. The campaign found an ally in SEIU, the Service Employees International Union. By August of 2013, the movement held a national strike against low pay day of action. Fast food workers and their supporters held demonstrations in 60 cities. Today, the movement has spread to 300 cities and beyond the United States. While protesters have gathered at many fast food chains, McDonald's has become a focus of the campaign. Protesters have held annual one-day demonstrations at McDonald's headquarters just outside of Chicago. The campaign has seen victories. Both New York and California have passed a $15 an hour minimum wage law. So has the city of Seattle. Although it's a national and even international movement, it is also a grassroots effort. In each city, different local groups are involved. In Kansas City, fast food women workers have formed the Fannie Lou Hamer Women's Committee. They named their group after the civil rights champion. They take inspiration from her famous quote that she was sick and tired of being sick and tired. For many in the Fight for 15 movement, this sums up their involvement. It is a movement for the respect and dignity of workers and the right to earn a living wage. Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
That's it for this week's edition of Labor History Today. You can subscribe to LHT on your favorite podcast app. And even better, you can like it right there and pass it along. Our music this week was the 2012 Fight for 15 official video, Fight for It, with AD, Arsonista, Brittany, and LV, produced by CORE and featuring Chicago's fast food and retail workers telling their stories of everyday struggles and why we still need to fight for 15. Find out more at fightfor15.org. Labor History Today is a member of the Labor Radio Podcast Network, working people's voices broadcasting worldwide 24 hours a day. You can find out more at laborradionetwork.org, where there are links to nearly 80 labor radio and podcast shows. If you like Labor History Today, I'm sure you're going to like some of these shows. Labor History Today is produced by the Metro Washington Council's Union City Radio and the Cal Manovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor at Georgetown University. The Labor History Today team includes Ben Blake, Patrick Dixon, Leon Fink, Sherry Lincoln, Joe McCartan, Evan Papp, Jessica Pozek, and Alan Weirdak. For Labor History Today, this has been Chris Garlock. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and healthy, but do keep making history, and see you next time.